Hello and welcome to House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. We've got a great show lined up for you all today. It is a massive weekend of Champions Cup rugby and myself and Fergus are going to chat about those Munster and Leinster games. Later on, Fergus will be joined by Ian Madigan and Chris Henry for a great discussion on some of their best European Cup memories, underrated teammates and Reece Ruddock running around in his underwear in the Shelburne Hotel. And there's a super interview I had with my Ireland teammates, Dorothy Wall and Bavin Parsons, that you'll really, really enjoy. OK, let's get to it.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. Game changed.
Well, unfortunately, there was no Leinster game on Friday. That one was cancelled due to a positive COVID test in their squad, and Leinster are now in the quarterfinals. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, but first we have to start with that heartbreaker from Munster. It feels like deja vu here. We're recording this episode on Saturday night and we're not long off Munster's 40-33 loss to Toulouse that has ended their European dreams for another year. Fergus, what did you make of the game?
Yeah, I thought it was a great game. Jeez, it was a brilliant game of rugby. You know, a lot of tries. Lovely day down in Thomond Park, and I thought both sides played some great stuff at times. Obviously, you have Toulouse playing that free-flowing style, but I thought Munster's performance really picked up from that final against Leinster, in fairness to them. But they probably just lost their way, you know, from in the last 20 minutes a little bit. They lost they lost their hold on the game. And, you know, Toulouse just pulled away. And, yeah, bitterly disappointing, I'd say, for those guys. But Toulouse were well worth the win, I think, in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. It really was a tale of two halves, and Munster took everything Toulouse could throw at them in the first half and still led 16-9 at the break. Was this the best you have seen Damian D'Alende play for Munster?
Yeah, probably. And then, like, it doesn't really get much bigger than that. You know, knockout stages of the Champions Cup, and he really stood up. I thought particularly after last week, he was relatively quiet against Leinster. I thought, you know, Robbie Henshaw and Rory O'Loughlin, you know, probably outplayed the Munster centres last week, but he was outstanding for Munster. Yeah, he really was brilliant. He gave him go forward ball, you know, all day. He made a couple of great breaks, particularly for the Keith Earls's second try, I think it was, where he made that initial break through the middle. So yeah, he had some big moments in the game, but unfortunately, it wasn't really enough to pull Munster over the line in the end.
No, it wasn't. And Toulouse came out in the second half and they were a completely different team and they managed to get on the score sheet really early. Munster have to be gutted about their defence of that try. You know, it was so early in the second half. It's the last thing you want to do or what you want to start the second half with. How, I suppose, you have to look at the Munster defence and question it there.
Yeah, and I think, listen, that Toulouse team is going to have its purple patches against any defence, really. You know, part of the way they play, it's kind of somewhat undefendable, really. And they managed to pull those plays together in the second half more so. I thought, you know, Munster really managed them, the opportunities that they gave them in the first half very well. And then the second half probably slipped off a bit. And then the problem is with Toulouse, when they get their tails up, the confidence just, you know, starts to flow through the team. And those, you know, passes out the back and those offloads just start sticking. And once they get in behind you, they're very, very difficult to stop. And that was kind of the way the game unfolded. I did think that the Toulouse bench probably added more than the Munster bench as well. You know, the likes of Joe Tacori came on and made a massive impact along with a few of the other forwards there, particularly in the scrum. So, yeah, great game of rugby, though. But Munster fans and the Munster players will be bitterly disappointed, yeah.
They absolutely will. And two players as well that will be disappointed not to have been there. Well, I suppose Peter Mahoney won, you know, with his injury not playing. But obviously Tadhg Byrne was on the field but went off with an injury and looked like he was really badly in pain. Like, two guys like that, you know, they're the type of guys you need in the second half that are going to pull it out when, you know, you really, really need it. And that must have had an impact on the team as well.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think, in fairness, you know, Tadhg was having more of an impact on that game than he had last week. I thought the way he played through the Six Nations, the amount of turnovers he got on the ground, you know, Leinster's ruck was particularly good last week. I'm not even sure how many, if he even got one. He could have got one last week, but he got a two or three against against Toulouse, particularly when they were putting high balls up on Intermac, and he managed those very well, took them in the air. But, you know, Tadhg was getting over the ball very quickly and turning over the ball there. One of them, I'm pretty sure, led to Keith Earls' first try, which was a brilliant piece of play from Munster in general. But the back row, though, for Munster, I thought stood up. You know, Gavin Coombs had an outstanding game. You know, he managed to get over for that try, which was, he showed incredible strength for that. But they definitely would have missed Peter O'Mahony's, you know, leadership for sure, because, you know, if he's playing there from the start, they could probably, they would have had maybe stronger guys coming in that last 20 minutes that could have been moved in off the bench. So he would have been missed today, yeah.
Yeah, like, I think Jack O'Donoghue was phenomenal, but I suppose traditionally had Peter O'Mahony been there, he probably wouldn't have been starting, and then you would have had that impact off the bench like they seem to have. You know, it was just the difference between the two teams. And we spoke about it last week, actually, that the, you know, halfbacks pairings, there isn't a better halfback pairing than Dupont and Entomac. And today they absolutely showed that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. I think they were brilliant. They seem to just get the balance right of the older kind of French generation of trying things and pulling it off, but also managing a game as well. I think they have a lovely balance there where it's not completely headless what they do, because I actually think Dupont, he probably manages the game for Toulouse and France. You know, the way he plays, he just marshals everyone around him. And then he has that X factor to make breaks. And you saw that line he ran for the kind of try that won them the game, where they made the break up the left-hand side. Brilliant feat by the winger, Lapel, and lovely ball back into Dupont. And he always runs that trail line. You know, he gets one of them a game these days. And it's just, it kind of sums up his work rate. And he kind of sees those things a little bit quicker than everyone else.
Yeah, they unfortunately do. I suppose in terms of positivity, it definitely was a better Munster performance based on last week. You know, Munster didn't really show up to that Pro 14 final. At least there was some positives, you know, some really good performances. Like you said, Gavin Coombs, Dielende was looking very sharp. Carberry looked, you know, the more games he gets under his belt, the better. And obviously Keith Earls, he's showing week in, week out that he still has it. I suppose going into the Rainbow Cup, I suppose everyone has forgotten about the Rainbow Cup. I think everyone, you know, even CJ at the end of the game there, people forgot that it mightn't actually be his last game for Munster. We still have Rainbow Cup to play. And moving into the Rainbow Cup, what can Munster fans cling onto? What positives can they cling to?
It's very hard to draw positives right now for them, really. You know, they've just got knocked out of the Champions Cup and they just got beaten in the Pro 14 final. So a really tough few weeks for the squad. You know, I do think that, you know, COVID has shown in these knockout games, you know, it can take the home advantage is massively taken out of the equation. I think that would have cost Munster for sure. I think that's the first time they got beaten in Europe there in 5 years. And you can be sure that the game probably would have at least been tighter if they had that home crowd. It's such a huge advantage for them. So I think they missed that today. But in terms of positives, I think that you know, from this season, you know, no silverware again, unfortunately for them, but they have some really, really talented young guys coming through. You know, Gavin Coombs, has been brilliant. You know, he was, for such a young guy, he was playing against one of the biggest packs around today. And, you know, he showed his worth and, his quality. And then you've got, you know, Craig Casey getting a bit more exposure. In fairness, Connor had a very good game, and he couldn't do a whole lot when he came on, but nice bit of exposure for him again. But you know, there's other guys as well that have gotten snippets of game time this year. You know, you've got that young second row Ahern, who was playing Irish 20s, and he's got a couple of games for Munster. So they do have some bright sparks coming through in the academy, and you know, hopefully that'll make them stronger next year.
Yeah, it's been a really difficult few weeks for Munster and Munster rugby players and Munster rugby supporters. But you're Johan van Graan going in on Monday morning to training. Like, what is it going to look like? Is there going to be a review? Is there going to be a preview? Is there going to be like a pep talk to G the boys up? Like, what, so in your experience, what needs and what has been done for the team? Because they do still have a busy few weeks ahead of them.
Yeah, they do. It's a tough thing to manage for coaches, and I suppose that the longer I went on in my career, you know, the more I realized that, you know, sometimes it's actually, you know, judging the mood in the camp as well. I'm sure these guys are going to be really devastated for the next few days. So, you know, Monday might be a little bit early to go straight into the review and start telling them what went wrong and that. Because as you say, they do have more rugby to play in the Rainbow Cup, but the reality is they're going to have to go over the stuff that didn't go well and the improvements that they need to make. So it'll be some tough viewing because, you know, the guys will be thinking enough about it. You know, when you lose a knockout game in the European Cup, you know, it's the guts of a week really until you can move on. So, you know, those guys will be hurting massively, but I'm sure Johan van Graam and the rest of the team, Stephen Larkham and that will, you know, try pitch it in a certain way, maybe, you know, from Tuesday onwards, just to move on, take the learnings and just try use the Rainbow Cup as a springboard.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll move on to Leinster's game. Bizarre situation, but I suppose it just sums up the current climate and the world that we live in at the moment. Leinster beat Toulon via a very bizarre decision. Leinster advanced to the quarterfinals after the EPCR awarded their last 16 game to them. Toulon had a positive COVID case on Wednesday, but that player did not travel to Ireland. However, as they were playing in Ireland, several of his teammates were deemed close contacts. All Toulon players were in Dublin and they tested negative, but as Toulon refused to replace six players that were identified as close contacts, the game was awarded to Leinster. Toulon say it is deplorable and it is a scandal. It's bizarre, really, to be honest, Fergus, isn't it? Do you have any sympathy for them?
Oh, of course, you have to have sympathy for them. You know, purely my Leinster hat on, you know, obviously it's great for them to get a bye in it. You know, in a European Cup knockout game. But, you know, when have you ever heard of that happening before? I think it sums up, as you say, the COVID world we're living in at the moment. It's fairly ruthless, you know, for the not to be able to be given the chance. You know, Toulon have worked hard enough to get themselves to this point. Sure, the staff and organisation and players would be absolutely gutted that they've kind of been taken out by this. Yeah, and on the flip side, Leinster, you know, leaves them in a strong position. They didn't play a game against a very tough side, which, you know, would have been a tough game to win, number one. But number two, they're not going to have those bashed bodies. They're going to have guys nice and fresh and even a longer lead-in period now to what looks like Exeter away, which is going to be a huge challenge.
Yeah, looking back, I suppose, to the COVID regulations, and like you've been involved in it, I'm currently involved in it still, and you know, if you're a close contact of somebody, well, one, you shouldn't be leaving your room. Two, you shouldn't be, you know, you should be self-isolating regardless of a negative COVID test. Like, I suppose we're so used to this, the structures in place, but it's so difficult to even comprehend how they would have got on a plane and how they thought they would have got away with it, or how they never did the close contact tracing.
Yeah. Well, I found out the hard way over in the Barbarians, that's for sure. But, you know, I was in environments where, in Leinster, where those COVID protocols were in play, and you know, it's a tough one. It's a tough pill to swallow for that Toulon team. I mean, it's hard to get your head around the fact that they don't get the opportunity, but the schedule is so tight now with the competition that, you know, the quarterfinals are just next week, and they can't move that because everything has been put back for so long, and the games are coming thick and fast now. So yeah, it sounds like there's a fair bit to the story there. I'm sure more and more will come out over the next few days. You know, Toulon don't sound like they're going to let this lie. So, but at the end of the day, the decision has been made. You know, from Leinster's perspective, it's just about preparing for this huge game now against the Exeter Chiefs.
Yeah, absolutely. And Exeter have just won that game 47-25 over Leon. So they definitely will have a tough task ahead of them. I suppose if we... I just think it's a bizarre situation because earlier on in the season, Toulon, that exact same team, they refused to play Scarlets because the Welsh side had a one positive COVID case in their camp. And here they are with, you know, one COVID case and six close contacts and then think they can get away with it. And then I think the match was suggested, or it was requested to play on Sunday, but their whole front row was out. Their six front rows are all close contacts. So because it's not feasible for them to play that game. But it must have been heartbreaking for the Leinster boys. Like, it was so late. Your captain's run done, your team is named, you're prepped. You know, the RDS is looking amazing. It was a perfect night for rugby. Have you been talking to any of the boys, or, you know, how late did they actually find out about it?
Yeah, I think it sounded like it was pretty last minute. You know, I don't think they're going to be the ones good at being honest. And like, listen, it was a nice opportunity for a couple of guys to put their hands up and play another game at home. But, you know, getting a bye in a European knockout game, they're not going to complain too much about that. That's a huge doggy life for Leinster to have gotten. And that could really work in their advantage now leading into, as I said, this really finally balanced kind of a schedule leading into the end of this competition. So it just means that, you know, they don't have that 80 minutes where guys could get injured. You know, they could have lost the game. Toulon are extremely good. They would have been preparing for that for quite a while. Star-studded team. So, from Leinster's perspective, I can imagine that they sound like they're fairly happy now with how things have worked out. And obviously, it's just disappointing for Toulon.
Yeah, and that leaves Leinster as the only Irish team left in the Champions Cup. Finally, before we get to your chat with Ian and Chris and my interview with Bavin and Dorothy, some Ulster fans have been upset that we haven't mentioned Ian Henderson on all our Lions talk for the last couple of weeks. Fergus, would you have Ian Henderson in your Lions squad?
Yeah, well, I probably would, yeah. But I mean, we were talking about Lions starters, so I'm not so sure he'll start. To be honest, he could, you know, depending on injuries, depending on the kind of form he puts in the Challenge Cup. Like, you'd imagine Ulster will get to the latter stages of the Challenge Cup. They could be, there's, you know, one of the best teams left in that competition. You know, and Ian Henderson's been playing some of his best rugby in years, but it's just such a competitive position. You know, Emer, you know, we all were kind of agreeing and disagreeing on the different combinations and different guys that could be in there. But Ulster fans, they shouldn't feel like we're being too biased or anything like that. We know all about Ian. It's just, you know, from my perspective, I'm not so sure he'll start, but I'd love if the guy travel, because he's played some great rugby this year.
Yeah, and I'm sure Gatland will answer that question very, very soon. Very good. Now, let's get to those interviews. I hope you enjoy.
Yeah, and it's exciting. Listen, this time of year, every year is great, you know, because as fans as well, they come off watching like a Six Nations campaign. You can look forward to the European knockout stages. And, you know, leading into that, I suppose the three of us are lucky enough to have some great memories in the competition. And what ones would stick out for you? Like, I remember when you guys went down to Munster as well in 2012. What was the feeling in the camp leading into that week, and where was your heads at in that?
Yeah, like that, when people ask me for my career, what was your, you know, one of your favourite Ulster games that you played in? That 2012 game in Thomond Park was probably the highlight for me in with Europe. I think as a player group, we were confident that we had a good team, but obviously going to Thomond Park, you know, one of the toughest places in world rugby to go to, especially then with the team that they had. So, I mean, look, we travelled down there with confidence, but, you know, we knew we had to come out the block really, really fast and start strong, and the game just came our way. You know, Craig Gilroy, I remember scoring a fantastic individual try, but I think we physically turned up and dominated them. You know, my biggest memories is, you know, Big Ferris, I think, had his, you know, one of his best games in an Ulster jersey. He just obviously dominated the breakdown. And when someone like that is leading from the front, everyone just, you know, lifted as well. And we had a good team then, you know. And when I look back at my Ulster career, we obviously unfortunately didn't win any trophies, but, you know, there was times where it was a serious strong spine of a team. You know, we had John Afoa at that stage, and just a good mixture of homegrown Ulster players coming into a good
young
age.
And old as well. You obviously Paddy breaking through, and then older guys as well there.
Yeah, there was a real good balance, you know. And also, sorry, the biggest thing was the Ulster fans that came down, and you know, they the Ulster fans had their best performance of the year. There were the noise of the stadium was just electric. And once you have a good moment, and it leads to another good moment, and the fans get behind you, and that's what European rugby is. There's so much emotion around European Cup rugby, and that's where I think felt that it was the first time where we, you know, really lived up to, you know, that the expectation, I guess, of European rugby. Whenever we weren't, you know, but previous to that, you know, we've been up, we'd won the league a few years before, but we never were a dominating force. So that was, for us, it was a big, big moment, and certainly something that I'll always remember. And that, you know, the final whistle, whenever, you know, Gara, I remember, you know, being able to play against someone like Gara, and you see him with his hands, his head, couldn't believe they lost at home in such a big moment. And us, the excitement, the exuberation, and Johan Müller, and I remember there's a picture of Cavey giving it stacks as well. And it was just a great moment. And obviously, we'd like to have had a few more of those moments and winning some silverware. But for a one-off game to win down a Munster like that, it was great memories, and very lucky to be part of that team.
Yeah, for me, with, you know, obviously I've been at Ulster now for, I think it's 8 or 9 months. And, you know, Ulster have had some huge days in the European Cup, beating some, you know, the French giants, especially at home in the Kingspan. And that game against Munster, as you touched on, and even 2 years ago against Leinster in the Aviva, like, and one thing that has struck me, and you won't hear Ulster, you know, shouting from the rooftop, but I do feel that there is an internal confidence there that, you know, they can beat anyone on their day.
Yeah, and like, this has been something that's been talked about for, you know, for the last 10 years when I was there. It's about being consistent, and it's not just being able to win those one-off games. And without a doubt, I mean, from an Ulster perspective, whenever you saw the draws and you had a big French giants coming to Belfast, or a big English Premiership teams, there is, like, European Cup game week, it's just different. You know, if you could bottle that feeling up and use it every week, whether it's the Dragons or whether it's Clermont, you know, you'd love, if the best teams, it doesn't matter who you play, you perform. But certainly there were stages that whenever I was with Ulster, our game's improved so much in those big moments, and that's the beautiful, that's the special, the extra edge that European rugby brings up. And it starts from, you know, the start of the week, the training week. There's different rugby balls that are brought out, the European Cup balls. There's more media attention. Everyone's maybe a wee bit more of an edge because there's so much
always more
of
a buzz.
You want to play
more
nerves
about who's going to get picked and all that sort of stuff. There's more disappointment. And then even managing the players that are very close and maybe playing most of the league games, playing outstanding, for whatever reason, they fall the wrong side of selection. And for them, you know, for coaches and also other players to kind of rally around and make sure that they're on the right, you know, the same page, because we all know that if those guys who are in the bibs for those weeks, if they're not training very well, you're not going to prepare in the same way. But going back to that, what you guys had mentioned about the internal confidence, and obviously you could see that from Ulster, particularly the last few years, and you were in a great team there for many years, Chris, and you're just unlucky that it was at a time where you couldn't win a trophy. But I remember after that you beat Munster down there, and the messaging for us on, like, you know, leading into, because I think it was a few weeks until the final, and you did a lap of honour, and we just go in our heads, we were going, these guys are just happy to be in the final, you know, and that was the flag for us straight away. We're like, these guys are just happy to be there. And I don't know, obviously you said there was an Ulster, like, crowd down there, but it's amazing what these small things can do for an added motivation for another team. And sometimes managing that, you need to be quite careful, you know?
Yeah, and I think actually Rory Best, I wonder after that moment of in Thoman when we did that lap of honour, it was such a big day for us, but in hindsight, 100%, like, moving forward after that, whenever we had big wins, you always were careful not to, you know, stay in the group stages and in the quarter final semifinals. Rory, I remember saying, right, let's just calm it down, because, you know, the end game was winning the trophy, it wasn't about just winning a quarter final. And I remember Rory after a lot of games going, right, let's just make sure, calm it down, this is not the final. And yeah, it's amazing that you guys actually remember that, because I actually don't remember doing a lap of honour. I remember celebrating a lot because we had a few weeks gap in between the quarterfinal in Munster to the semi-finals, which was Edinburgh. And yeah, like, we obviously, you know, we went back and we had a great bus trip back. And I remember going to, so the morning after that quarterfinal, I had to go to get physio. So you know, it must have been, you know, mid-morning or lunchtime, and I was driving from my house to the physio room, or to the training venue, and where my house is, there's a big roundabout on the way to the training venue. There's four big statues up there, so you have to drive past it to go around. And whenever I drove around, I could see an Ulster jersey on one of the statues. So I kind of caught myself going, gosh, the Ulster fans must have just put up. But then I drove around and you could see it was number 12. So it was Paddy Wallace's jersey. So I'm not saying that Paddy Wallace was somehow on this roundabout in the early hours of the morning. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Paddy. I think he swapped the jersey with somebody else, maybe one of the younger players. But like everyone that day, then fans were, you know, Ulster fans who were driving would have beat their horns because the jersey was on the statue. So yeah, like that's just the difference. That shows the difference that where Leinster were that year in 2012 compared to where we were. You know, as you said, it was a brilliant win for us. But you know, I look back in that final in 2012 in Twickenham, which was, you know, 80,000 people watching. You know, it was a big, big moment, of course, in my career. But I don't have regrets because we weren't the better team. You know, Leinster used were by far the best team. I don't think anyone else in Europe were going to beat you on that day. And yeah, like it just shows where Leinster, you know, that was in 2012, and look where Leinster still are now. And yeah, it was fantastic memories in day, but certainly hindsight, I've no regrets on Leinster winning and us not winning in 2012.
Yeah, what's tough there for Ulster, and you know, I think I've experienced something similar in the short time I've been at the club, was that, you know, in 2012, if you looked at the two squads there, you would have thought, age profile wise, you know, you would have thought Ulster are going to be the team maybe that could be the force in Irish rugby over the next 5 years. Leinster definitely had a more ageing squad. You look at the likes of, you know, Owen Redden, Isaac Boss,
Nasiwa,
Gordon Darcy, Brian O'Driscoll, Leo Cullen. There was guys, you know, Shane on the Jennings, other side of their, yeah, Shane Jennings, guys on the other side of their career. You look at, you know, the Ulster squad, there was a very young backline coming through, you know, the likes of Hendy in the pack, yourself, that would have had been coming into your prime.
Craig Gilroy.
Yeah, Gilly was playing, you know, fantastic stuff.
Katie.
But, you know, for me, this year with Ulster, like we got into the final against Leinster, it was a different squad. And, you know, not that we weren't expecting to win it or we didn't think we could win it, but I think playing in that final off the back of it, we now realise, you know, we're actually good enough. You know, we competed for a period of time in that final. We've played Leinster a couple of times since. We know that we can go toe-to-toe with them, and you know the belief is there for me in the current group. Like, what do you think it was that you just didn't kick on from that European final and get a trophy?
You know, there was a couple of semi-finals where we were played Leinster down in Leinster the final was played in Leinster the league, because Kingspan was being refurbished. So I think that was a big moment. I do believe that if that was played in a neutral venue, or especially Kingspan, I think that could have been a different day.
That was the year you just went like 14 in a row.
We won the league, but we obviously had to play in the playoffs. And then the other year, Ulster played Glasgow away in a semi-final, and we were winning the game the whole way through. And I think it was Ricky Lutton pulled the Glasgow scrum half right at the end, and then the penalty was reversed and they went up the other end and scored last play of the game. So two moments that I go, yes, there was trophies that have gone missing in Ulster. And it's, you know, now I've hung up the boots, I don't think about it, you know, hardly at all until I'm talking with old rugby friends. But it is those, I regret those moments way more than what I do in that 2012 final, because as you renamed off all those Leinster players, and yes, we had our John Afoa, Tom Courts, and, you know, real good spine to our team, but we not the same calibre, I guess, of what that Leinster side. And I do think Ulster, from someone who's been out away from Ulster for 2 years now, I think being in the Challenge Cup could be the best thing for that group. You know,
it could be a great stepping stone, like, to win that. It's not an easy competition to win.
Absolutely not.
There's an awful lot of good teams that are still in that, and you know, it's often, you know, that success there can breed success going forward, you know, in the actual Champions Cup, and whether it's domestically as well, it can be a really good springboard. So I think it is a great opportunity for you.
And you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think Ulster have ever played in the Challenge Cup. You know, the only province I think that haven't had to go in the Challenge Cup, just the way it's worked out. So it's a fresh tournament. It's completely new. It's obvious, like, yes, there's some great teams there. You know, Montpellier, London Irish, who they're playing well. But there's no, the fear factor for Ulster definitely shouldn't be there. It's like the psychology of it, a bit of momentum. I just think that there's a great young group at Ulster at the moment, and there's no reason why this couldn't be there. This couldn't be a great avenue for us to lift the trophy for the season. Great opportunity, like, anyway.
Well, you touched on it there, Fergie, saying like a stepping stone. Like when Leinster won it in, I think it was 2013 maybe, or
and then Hamlin Cup.
We won the Europe, the Champions Cup the following year.
We won the league the following year.
Do we not win the Champions Cup the following year?
No, we won.
It's hard to remember, isn't it? It's just so many.
But no, you're right.
Like, I'm going home. I'm finished.
No, but
so listen, why do you think we didn't win a trophy? Can we go back on that question again? But
I'm out of here.
Which one was it?
But the league next year. Yeah. But I know what I actually think it did for that team was there was a couple of European successes, and it probably humbled the group a little bit. Because we weren't where we needed to be, and we're talking about nights. Remember great European nights. I remember some pretty bleak ones as well. Like I remember heading over to Claremont, and we got beaten pretty well over there. And then we came back, and they also beat us in Dublin, and we didn't get out of the group stages, and that's why we ended up in the Amlin Cup. But we're talking about great days, but there's. You invest so much as it's the most you invest from a club level, as players and a group. Your goal at the start of the year, I'm sure it has been for all the years you were playing, was really to win it. If you have any sort of backbone in your team or good squad, you have to be ambitious enough to win it. And I suppose these are the weeks, and we're talking about big days and all the rest, but those days are so, so important. The prep each day, making sure the detail is right early on the week. Like, I'm not sure what difference have you found for European weeks from say being, in a Bristol, being in Bordeaux, being in Leinster, to being up in Ulster. What's the difference?
Yeah, definitely being with Leinster or Ulster, it's a real switch. The Irish sides hold Europe on a real pedestal in France and in England. They're probably on parity. So you don't quite feel the exact same buzz, but speaking of my experience with Ulster and Leinster, everything from when the team's getting announced to that European music coming on, it's like the squad doubles for European games. I don't know what it is. Obviously, all your internationals are back in. All these players who've been injured seem to come out of the woodwork, and it's
all the lads that couldn't play against the Dragons. Like,
I'm available.
I'm good now. I'm fit. Yeah, cheers.
So it's it makes for a very competitive training week. That was one thing I always remembered. It was just how ferocious the training was, because everyone knew that it's nearly test match standard going into a top level European game. And even walk the two teams walking out together. They're small things, but you notice as a player, geez, it's different this week. We're on here. It's Europe.
Massively so. But I remember the Northampton game in 2011, just going back on, I suppose, a few memories, and that one was just a really special one. I remember the two of us were on the bench, but over the years, I know people talk about the halftime chat that Johnny had made, but really, I remember so much going on, and I remember him talking. What was your recollection of it?
Yeah, I remember, obviously we've played in games where things aren't going well and you just don't regain control, but sometimes you can get a feeling, even though you might go 15 or 20 points down, you get a feeling kind of going, we're not out of this yet. And there definitely wasn't that feeling at halftime of any loss of control. Obviously Johnny spoke and spoke really well. But I remember Joe stepping in and just being so clear in his delivery of messages on what wasn't done in the first half, but how close it is to working, to go out and execute it in the second half. And, obviously as an out half, I'm just thinking strategy and what plays are you thinking off line out, what plays are you thinking off scrum. And it was an amazing performance in the second half, but it was looking back on it, seeing what he said actually coming to life and players executing in the second half and getting those tries to get us back into the game. And ultimately what happened there for me was we just broke Northampton. you know, and there was a kind of feeling, even with like 15 minutes to go, there was a feeling, this game is done, it's over.
It's funny though, how certain moments can turn a final, you know, like it could be a scrum penalty. Remember our scrum was going backwards. The proper had the reverse lights on in the first half, and then I think one of the first scrums in the second half, in the first couple of minutes, scrum penalty. And then you're going, like, then the belief just starts setting, you can feel that, like, just, you know, filtering through to everyone in the team. And on the flip side then, I remember in, you know, I was watching the game, I didn't get picked, but the final in 2019 against Saracens, and just a few moments that you could see the belief was almost, it was just draining out of the lads. The couple of things that Saracens just kept getting right, we were pounding their line on several times, just crucial turnovers, you know, Liam Williams getting the ball back one time, stuff like that, such energy kind of boosters for one team and such a drainer for the other. It's interesting how they play out, because the margins really in the finals, for majority of finals, they're not much, you know, so it's just about getting those smaller moments.
It's funny you say that. Like, I remember in that Northampton game, we had like a kind of surging attack and someone threw like a dreadful pass, and like Leo, like, you know, obviously he's a fantastic player, but like wouldn't have had the most amazing hands and probably not the most flexible guy either, but I'll never forget.
He wasn't throwing your skip passes anyway.
I'll never forget this.
He would have put his back out of it.
This catch he made leading up to, I think, one of Johnny's tries.
It was like he had super glue in his hands.
Yeah, it was up, but it's funny, like, I don't remember a whole lot, but that was one thing that stepped out in my mind. I remember just thinking, geez, that was a huge moment. You knock that on, they exit, the game can get away from you.
Yeah, I know. And I suppose that, like, lead me on to another point of, you know, hostile environments to go to, because you're talking there about Ravenhill and the difference that would have made. Like, we know from being a Leinster player for a long time, we know how tough it is to go there. Like, it's such a tough place to go. When you have a full crowd there, it's so difficult. It's so difficult to come away with a win. I think you play a different team when you play Ulster up there. But what were the tougher grounds that you went to that were maybe outside of the country, not Irish?
I think you mentioned the team a few minutes ago about Clermont away. You know, the noise of that stadium in Clermont is incredible, and obviously you're playing against, like, in European Cup, as you mentioned, the internationals are off there, so you've got your two best teams coming at each other. And whenever we play Clermont, you know, we came out to blow. It was such a great pitch as well, so the game just started at such a frantic pace, and the offloads, and you're just going, and then it feels like the crowd's on top of you, and every mistake, it's just
they have
that
those
noise.
Little batons as well,
so the batons, they don't stop banging those until the fans know that the Clermont have won. They don't stop banging these. So I remember going in the game, like, for the lineout. So for the lineout, we had, you have to prep that if you can't hear the call, you need that we had calls where we had to, like, speed it up, because you knew, right, if we make a call when you're in the lineout, you won't be, if you're behind, you can't hear. So you can't hear your trigger call. So we, like, literally had, like, so many calls where it was like, right, if you're, you know, obviously hand signals, things like that, just to quicken up and give us options, because there's times where you cannot hear what is going on, what the call is. So it's just the intimidation.
Because the capacity there isn't even that. I think it's something like 18,000.
But you're coming
it
from...
It literally sounds... Change rooms are so deep.
But change rooms are so deep.
It's a perfect rugby stadium, though. Like, it's like four walls, and then there's a mix of terracing as well on ground level.
Yeah.
So, like, you feel like the crowd are right on top of you. Yeah. And then, obviously, having people standing around creates, you know, a very special kind of rugby atmosphere that you wouldn't get in a soccer stadium as such.
I think their crowd as well, it's kind of... the city is made up for a really good following for rugby side. Industrial city.
Big time.
You know, that's the main team. They don't really have a soccer team there. They're a very good team. But yeah, some of the experiences, never won over there, but the experiences, yeah, I'd agree with you. Probably the toughest place I played in Europe. But another one that would stick out for me would have been Toulon. We went over to play them. We were both involved in this game, Mads, I think, where we had Matt O'Connor was the coach, and we had them in the group stages. And I think it was 2015. Sorry, it wasn't actually. It was the quarter final. Do you remember we got to a quarter final and got knocked out?
Yeah.
We got knocked out of a quarter final and it was over there.
Yeah.
And
Leo coached then, was he? No.
No, I don't think he was.
This is earlier on, yeah.
Yeah, but they throw their newspapers up in the air
when they
think their team is, you know, won. And unfortunately, they all have a newspaper underneath their seat and they fire it in the air. And I think it was like 15 minutes in, the newspapers were up. I was like, oh, jeez, this is going to be a long day at the office. That was the team when they had Gitto, they had Wilkinson, they were winning the three in the row, the two Armitage brothers.
Pack as well. Their pack was so strong. I remember it was like running into a brick wall. It's a small pitch as well.
Yeah.
It just felt like there was no space that day.
Mm. Very tough. Another point that I'd like to kind of talk to you about is, I suppose, the culture of coaches, I suppose, in years gone by, you know, pitching a group in a way where you're driving the emotional energy up in the group and in the room, maybe right before the game or days before. And I think from coaches that I've had recently and in the past few years and successful ones, that's probably gone out of the game. You know, what experiences do you have where, I suppose there's an example of Declan Kidney. I suppose he had all the Munster boys crying the night before the 2000 Heineken Cup final against Northampton. And, you know, unfortunately for them, they lost the game. So I think there's probably, it's debatable as to know what exactly is the best thing to do.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, that's probably one of the things that changed the most from whenever I was a 21, 22-year-old and a 30-year-old in that Ulster team or with Ireland. You could win games without a doubt. Back in the day before, teams were professional, but were they really that next standard? And I think teams feeding off the passion and, you know, bouncing off the walls and crying. And, you know, I remember my first few caps for Ulster, I was so nervous that I'd have to go to the toilet and be sick.
Hmm.
Before my first Irish cap, I can't remember, but I'm sure I probably was retching because of nerves. So you have your pre-match meals and all that sitting there, and you have adrenaline. As you get older, and I think the professional teams nowadays, like the psychology around it all, you cannot waste energy in that way. Like me being sick before test match, and well, that's energy. I needed that to be able to keep going. And you know, it sounds still stupid, but 1%, there's small margins. And I do think that when I first started, you were team talks were loud, aggressive. You know, people were bouncing off the walls. That didn't happen in my last, you know, 5 years playing pro rugby, because you knew that if you were able to perform, yes, there's always going to be emotional. You're always going to bring emotional edge to rugby. It has to mean something more to you.
Mm.
But you can't waste your energy the way.
Yeah, I think it's about channeling it in a certain way. And
don't get me wrong, like I love, like it's still, rugby will always have an emotional side to it, and to see tears, I know you love a good cry during a rugby pitch, but yeah, you can't, the game has changed, you have to
Maz
make...
Maz and CJ, crying together. Oh, he actually probably outcried you there the other week, in fairness. But listen, a lot of focus on the Six Nations these past few weeks, and Dev Toner setting that record yesterday, and what a fitting, like to be the most capped Leinster player of all time, and so durable. You know, we've all played with him and are great friends with the guy. What a top man and an amazing player. And I suppose in ways you could say Dev was, and I know he has 70 caps for Ireland and he has all these trophies, but in ways you could probably call him underrated. Would you agree?
Yeah, like he's not a player who grabs the headlines, or if he's not in the team on a given week that they're going, oh geez, we're in trouble, Dev's not in. But we had the joy of playing with him, all three of us, and he was just a guy who consistently produced every single. Like, it was always sevens, eights, every single weekend. If you look through his, you know, 300, the guts of 350 professional games he's played, how many times has he had a five, or you know, even, you know, four or five? Never. Like, he's just rock solid.
How many people has he injured in those 300?
Incredible.
Including his own teammates.
Similar to that number.
Yeah.
Even when he'd run into you in training, it was always a very unenjoyable experience. You always seem to cop a knee or an elbow.
I'm convinced his bones are made of different, something different than what they're...
I remember one of the camps. I mean, to reach those numbers that you just said, you have to be so durable.
Oh.
And I, one of the days...
In that position as well.
In that position, you know, unbelievable. And he was on a physio bed one day, and I remember everyone just going, geez, Deb's on a physio bed, what's going on? And it was I'm pretty sure it was an ankle. And yeah, it was finally strapped up and he played. You know, he never got massage
treatment, which is like for a forward, like getting like bangs rubbed out and stuff.
Optional yoga?
No, no yoga.
I mean, from my perspective, like I
stretched his hamstring before he ran. Not that I don't think he has any, but going on to just talking about kind of underrated players, and I suppose ones you've played with. Another one I thought an outstanding game yesterday. He's been playing great rugby for a number of seasons now, particularly this year, was Reese. And I think he's a guy that, like, anyone that has played with him or played against him would not underrate him in any way. But what I'm trying to say is, you look how many caps he has. Like, that guy should have more caps. And I just don't understand why he doesn't. But for me, he was just one of those guys that, like, you play with him and you know, he's one of the first people you want on your team sheet beside you, just in the trenches on a tough day. Like, what examples could you give from guys over the years that you would say were maybe a little bit underrated?
I mean, Reece, the obvious one that jumps on me, just because I played with him for such a long time, from even like Irish schools the whole way up, against for Leinster's Kevin McLaughlin. I think the Kev could have got, he had an unbelievable Leinster career, obviously, but I don't know how many Irish caps he had, but in a different time, I think he could have got a lot more. Obviously, had to finish with career-ending injury. From an Ulster perspective, I think someone that is quite underrated, even though he's had a great Ulster career, is Luke Marshall. So yeah. Luke's been suffered such a bad luck with injuries. Obviously, there's so many centres in Ireland and in Ulster, young pups coming through. But every time Luke comes back from an injury, he kind of reminds you. Then you go, oh gosh, I remember now why he's so good. He's such like a defensive leader for that Ulster team. And I don't know how many caps he's had for Ireland. I don't think it's even in double figures, but I think...
Still a young man.
He is still a young man, yeah. And I mean, you obviously... I don't know when he's due to come back.
Yeah, even touching on that, like, you can see... I think it's... Yeah, you almost have to play with these guys in their team to fully appreciate them. And I think as players, it's about seeing the unseen work. You know, and like, in fairness to Fergie, like, you were, you know... one of the best I've played with on that front. But Luke, he's very similar.
Ferger's very underrated. You should have way more caps.
I probably was, actually. I think we need to take a full section to talk about that. No, I'll give you that 50 quid after, man. Thanks a million.
No, but it's going from ruck to ruck. It's making a selfless run to run a dummy line. It's, you know, chasing back when someone breaks through. And you only really pick up on these things when you're doing a full game review with your own team. And if you see the same guys popping up over and over, you just develop this unbelievable respect for them. And Lukey Marshall is definitely one of them. Dev is another one of them. Reese, you know. Someone like Owen Redden, you know, for me, when I was coming through, I would have been really nervous before games. And like, one thing that definitely would have calmed my nerves would have been knowing what the guys around me were going to bring. And, you know, playing with Redzer, he would have been someone I know he's going to, you know, be guaranteed to have a 7 or an 8. You know, the core parts of his game are going to be on. He's going to know all his detail, and that would have settled me down a lot and given me confidence in my own game.
Speaking of selfless actions, do you have a bit of a story about Reese off the pitch where
I have a good wee story about Reese Ruddock. So in 2014 we were rooming together during the autumn series, and we were due to play South Africa, and I was due to start, and I suffered a mini stroke that morning. So obviously pretty life-changing event for me, but Reese was my roommate. So we're in the Shelbourne the morning of the test match. I was due to start feeling great, went into the toilet first thing we woke up, and the mini stroke came on, so I lost my voice, side of my face dropped, my arm, all the strength of my arm dropped, so pretty scary. But I mumbled to Reese. So Reese jumps out of bed, comes into the bathroom, and, you know, I couldn't speak to him, but he could see that something pretty serious was going on. So Reese then just ran straight out of the door to get help. So he ran through the Shelbourne, past all guests, staff, through the hotel lobby to find the Irish doctor. I think he ran back, you know, him and the doctor were back in our room within like 6-7 minutes, and at that stage I had recovered and was all fine. But what the hero that Reese was, so Reese slept in his boxer shorts, and that was it. Yeah. So instead of Reese, you know, going, oh gosh, right, I better grab a t-shirt or shorts or tracksuit bottoms. He went, no, I just got to get help. So he ran out the door just in his boxers. All this
running around the main bar in the shop.
Running around the bar shouting for help. And, you know, obviously Reece is in good shape. So I think every female guest and female staff, you know, had a real treat that day by seeing Reece, you know, just in his boxer shorts. But no, I like that. And then Reece ended up starting.
He played in the game, yeah.
Started my position. Scored a try, pretty sure got man of the match. He was brilliant.
But turns out he actually drugged you.
Yeah, he did drug me on that before.
Yeah.
But no,
he just ran his boxers to make it realistic that it wasn't him. But on that note, lads, that's a great story to finish with. Cheers for that. That was great.
They will be great value. They'll be great value. And you'll be able to really buzz off them, and they will buzz off one another. And you won't be shy of laughs. Your sides will be sore from laughing. They know each other very well. And do you know what? It's just, I hope they know where to leave things, because it is a show that everyone's going to see, and it's a family show. So they can be bold, the two of them, but good value. So I'm going to tune in.
It is my pleasure to welcome my Irish teammates. I've got Bavin Parsons, Connacht, an Irish winger, and I've got Dorothy Wall, Munster, an Irish back row. Girls, we've been trying to have you on for a long time, and we finally got you on ahead of the Women's Six Nations. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you. So excited to talk to you, and I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy this conversation. I suppose you two have been so lucky that you have started playing rugby from a really young age, completely different rugby journey to me. But we're going to just talk about your rugby journey and how you got to where you are now, two absolute rising stars in Irish women's rugby and the future of Irish women's rugby. Dorothy, you've three brothers. It has to have started somewhere there, your rugby experience.
Yeah, I suppose my three brothers always played down in Feathered, and my dad would have coached, and we'd be a very kind of rugby orientated family. And my mum, we would always kind of rode horses and stuff. But during transition year, Polly Murphy down at the club was like, look, will you give the rugby a go? Because I actually haven't said this before, but when I was like 5 or 6, I went down to one of the rugby sessions. But I actually got really nervous and scared and saw all the boys on the try line. And I actually was like, Dad, no, Dad couldn't force me to go down. So I left when I was 5 or 6, which I'm not very proud of. But I came back when I was 16 then and got into it, played for the school in Feathered. And that's where it all started for me, I guess.
Did it help having three brothers at home, you know, that you're able to play with and I suppose rugby tackle and use them as the punch bag?
Are you joking? They would not come out and pass with me if their lives depended on it. I'd be lucky to get them out. And they're all kind of into kicking and stuff. And like the toe poke is my speciality because they're all backs, I think. So they'd be out like place kicking and, you know, grubbers and whatnot. And it doesn't really suit me that well. So we'd be different. But sometimes Andrew, the youngest, will come out passing with me. But he generally goes inside fairly quickly.
all the skillful kind of things you're talking about there, are you trying to say that you're not very skillful, Daryl?
Oh, no, sure. I'd never say that. But I will. If you see me kicking a ball in a game, you know we're in massive trouble.
Note to self, hopefully you won't see that anytime soon. So you started off at the age of 16 you went and you played rugby at 16. So not late, I suppose, relatively young as well. And tell us about your journey then. You started with Feathered Rugby Club and continued on to Munster. And tell us how you got to the Irish women's senior team.
So I started in Feathered, played under 16 and under 18 with Feathered. We travelled to Cork, Limerick, was down in Rose Green and Feathered 2 nights a week. My mum would she's done serious mileage behind the wheel, like getting me to different training sessions. And then from club there was Munster underage, and we'd be down in Cork or Limerick twice a week, and I loved that. And we had a great kind of setup that year, and myself, Enya and Emily were actually the back line, would you believe, for the Interpros, and we won our last year with Emily at 10, me on the wing and Enya at centre. So that was a good year. And then from there, just kind of went into underage sevens, went to the Loughborough school games and like the Youth Olympic qualifiers in Vichy. So from underage sevens, I was brought into the senior sevens program just after my leaving cert. So I've been in the sevens program for 3 years and got captain Ukraine in 2019. And then I was brought into 15s in late 2019 as well. So that's how I'm here today. It's been a lot of rugby, but I've enjoyed it all.
A lot of rugby. I think the one thing about both yourself and Bavin is that you're so lucky. You've so much rugby played and your 21st birthday is coming up on May the 4th. So you still have so many years ahead of you. So many years.
Put it in the diary.
Absolutely. We'll have to celebrate that one. Bay, you weren't as scared of the boys, unlike Dorothy over here. You started off your rugby. You started off your rugby career playing with the boys.
Yeah, I suppose I did. I was under the impression that it was a mixed team. I found out fairly quickly it wasn't very mixed. I was the only girl. So, you know, they use that term very generously. But yeah, I think it was like under 10s or under 11s. And I loved it. I played a full season. We got to community games final. You know, it was class. And then turned up the following season looking to play again and was told, you know, you can't play with the boys anymore. So that was me then at about 11, 12, hanging off the rugby boots and going back to Gaelic football, thinking that was the end of my rugby career. Little did I know.
And Bae, why do you think they told you can't play anymore? Was it genuinely because you were running rings around the boys?
No, I wish that was the case. But I think you just get to a stage where like the boys start to outgrow you and, you know, it just becomes a bit of a rule that you're not allowed to play anymore. But then a couple of years later, we set up a girls team and it was colossal. Like we had about 40 odd girls at training and it just took off in a huge way. And since then, you know, I probably skipped a couple of steps, played with Connacht under 18s. And then luckily got onto the Irish sevens, met Griggsy there as a head coach. And he sort of fast tracked me onto the senior setup at 16. So it was not your typical textbook rugby pathway, but sure, we got there in the end.
Yeah, and for anyone who doesn't realise, like, Bavin was 16 years old playing her first game against the United States in Donnybrook. Like, it's a phenomenal achievement. But what's even more bizarre is that you weren't actually allowed to play interpros at senior level, but you played your first international senior game. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was weird. You know, I was told I can't play senior club or I can't play senior province. I still haven't, you know, played my first club match at senior level, so still waiting to tick that box. Yeah, no, it was weird, and I was definitely out of my depth. So that, like, in that USA game, I'd never fully, you know, grasped. You know, I didn't have a smart rugby brain at that stage. So definitely not working up through the pathways showed a little bit, but I think the last few years of training under my belt, I've sort of grown into the position a bit more.
I wouldn't say that, babe. And I think, you know, if you're old enough, you're good enough. And I think you have proved that, like, at the end of the day, it's not that long ago that you got your first cap. And I remember that very clearly. Your very first cap, your mum dropped you off into the lobby of the hotel and she chatted to me and a few of the girls, the older girls who were there, and she just asked us to mind you. Like, you were going to play an international rugby game against the USA and your mum was so worried for you.
Oh, I don't think she could, even still, I don't think she can make it through a full match without, like, putting her hands over her eyes. Like, the poor woman just can't stand rugby, but she makes it to all the matches anyway.
Yeah. How special was that first cap? I suppose for anyone, I think for me, coming from a Gaelic football background, the first cap ceremony is probably one of the most special, special occasions in my rugby career. And even that jersey presentation the night before, we had Lynn Cantwell speaking to us, you know, phenomenal rugby player who has done it all really with Irish women's rugby. And I remember she had a great speech, a really, really inspiring speech that day, and she presented us our jerseys. But how nervous were you ahead of that game?
Yeah, I remember Lynn's speech as well. I remember how much she talked about, you know, the passion and her love for the Irish jersey and the green colour. I suppose at the time, I think I was so young and so naive that I didn't realise how big of a deal it was. And now, only in reflection and with COVID and having time to look back on things, I realised how sort of colossal that was and that was the start of my journey. So I think if I was to get my first cap tomorrow, it would nearly be more nerve-wracking because it means so much more to me. But at the time, I think I was so overwhelmed with everything going on that I was just like zooming through the whole experience, not even able to take it in.
And is that why you were so overwhelmed that you managed to lose your jersey on your first cap night?
Emer, I didn't think you'd do me like that.
Tell us a little bit about that story.
So I may or may not have allegedly lost my first cap jersey. And I was in bed the night before a match, trying to get as much season as possible. And I wake up in a cold sweat. I literally cannot for the life of me remember where my jersey is. And note to self, don't ever ring the manager as your first port of call. Ring your players.
Rookie mistake.
So I'm frantic, pacing up and down the hotel room. Bear in mind, I couldn't have a roommate because I was 16 and it was against child safety regulations or whatever.
So I don't even know.
And so I ring Elaine Ryan at the time. She was our manager and she's freaking out. I'm freaking out. Don't have a clue where my jersey is. She's trying to source another one. Like, as far as I know, it just evaporated into thin air until the next morning, Laura Feely taps me on the shoulder, hands me my jersey. Did you forget something, baby? And God, yeah.
I
tell you, I didn't get much sleep that night. Yeah. Is an understatement.
So not only did you get your first cap at 16, you also had a sleepless night worrying about where your jersey was. But that's definitely a memorable moment. Dorothy, you got your first cap a whole year later in the next Six Nations. Your whole family were there. I remember seeing your gran. She was there, one of your main supporters. And we met her during Family Day last year at the Aon Family Day. You know, I played with you at Munster. I knew what you were capable of. I knew that you were absolutely ready to play rugby for Ireland. But you also have a very similar funny story about that day where you ended up texting your cousin Matt instead of Dr. Matt that day. And this is one of the funniest stories, and I think it's worth the airwaves.
Do I have to tell this?
Absolutely.
Story? Oh my god! So I actually can't believe you've done this to me. I had kind of a funny stomach on the day of the match, and I texted Matt, who I thought was the team doctor at the time, and I said, oh, Matt, my stomach feels really funny. Is there anything I can take? Because, you know, it's match day and I don't want to be feeling sick for the game. And so I texted Matt and he was like, I can recommend like these alkaline things, or have you tried like some ice water or going for fresh air? And I was like, yeah, this is really helpful, but can you actually give me the medication or whatever? Because, you know, I need it. And he kept like recommending stuff and I was like, oh, can I get that off you? And then Matt was like, I'm actually in the States right now. Are you in America as well? And I was like, wait, like I've made a big mistake here. Turns out it was my 25-year-old American cousin who I WhatsApped about my stomach issues on the day of my first cap, who gave me lots of lovely advice, but was not who I wanted to know about
that. He was really, really kind. He was really kind with his life.
No, he's a great guy. Like, oh my God, to say I was mortified. And now I'm even more mortified because... Oh my God.
Did you ever text Dr. Matt and actually get to the right Matt that time?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I got sorted. But he told me to come up to his room straight away. But sure, that would have been what would have made sense in the first place. But I wasn't really thinking straight.
Yeah,
but,
well, look, I think
we got over that hump.
I think you were both proof that first caps are stressful. And that's absolutely proof to the pudding that, you know, it's not always plain sailing. But going back to the actual game, yeah. Dorothy, of your first cap, you were phenomenal when you came on. You hit everything that moved. How special was it for you and your family? And obviously your gran was there, but your dad was there, your mum was there. There was cousins. How special was it for them, for you and for you to get your first cap?
Oh, yeah, like probably one of the best days I've had. Like, it was great. Like, it was great to just get on the pitch, because when you're on the bench, it's like you're playing the match, but physically you're not, but mentally you're there. So I nearly exhausted myself in the first half. I was so into it. Like, I was actually a little bit drained. But then once I got on, kind of got into the flow of the game, really enjoyed it and was like, right, okay. I kind of settled once I made the first hit and that kind of worked for me there. And it was great, like, to have me there. And a load of my friends actually came up from UCD who wouldn't have really rugby brains. Like, when I was warming up in the sideline, they were screaming, like, and I hadn't even gone on. Like, I was just warming up and they were screaming my name. And in fact, it was a little embarrassing, but I loved the support. But no, it was great. It was great to have everyone there.
Yeah, that's something that we'll definitely miss, you know, this year with the Six Nations. Obviously, you guys both played in November. What was it like without having crowds there, Bae?
Yeah, it was weird. Like, I don't think you realise this, the extra 1% that, like, having the crowd there gives you. You know, even in your warm-up and the buzz and us knowing that the whole stadium, especially when it's on in Donnybrook, are behind you, you know, it makes you push that extra bit harder. It makes you run when your legs are dead. You know, that extra 1%. Like, you can still muster up the courage to win a match no matter what when you're wearing a green jersey, but having the support of a full crowd and a full stadium, you know, cheering for you and cheering for your country, it does give you that extra oomph.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I suppose, all joking aside, it is a pleasure to play with the two of you. And, you know, how have you both found the jump from underage rugby to senior rugby? We'll go to you, Doro, first. And, like, what advice would you give younger girls that want to make that jump from under 18s that have probably missed out on a year's worth of rugby in the last while with COVID? You know, they've missed out on that year of playing and training together. But what advice would you give them?
I think asking questions is huge, and being proactive in how you learn, and, you know, like, getting all the advice from these really experienced players on the pitch. And then in terms of the team, like, you have to be able to give them back the slagging they give you, because, like, there's only one way to earn that respect, and that's to be able to give it back and take it. And I've learned that the hard way, because, you know, I wouldn't say bullying is the term, but I've certainly got my fair share of slagging in the last while, but I've come to terms with it. So you have to give as good as you get and just be proactive about improving and getting knowledge off older players, I think.
Yeah, and who would be the worst on the team for the slagging, Daryl?
Oh, it has to be the captain, Kira Griffin.
And me.
Like, I don't know how she's gotten away with it thus far, but look, I'm not complaining, I, you know.
Wait till she sees those pink boots at the weekend.
Oh God, I'm ready.
Ready for it. What about
you? Me and know all about the pink boots slagging.
I actually saw the back three the last day and they all were wearing pink boots. And I was like, what's the crack with everyone going back to pink boots again? I thought that was so 2 years ago, but no, they're back on the pink boots thing.
That was so 2 years ago.
I never left the pink boots.
I'm clearly not trending at the moment without my pink boots. Babin, what about you? What advice would you give girls that want to make that jump from underage up to senior level?
Yeah, I think a major thing is giving yourself that grace period to, you know, get used to senior rugby. Don't be too hard on yourself on those first few trainings back. You know, everyone's going to be rusty. Things are going to be new. Systems are going to be new. It's going to be that little percentage faster. You know, give yourself that grace period to get used to the game, settle in, get to know your teammates. And, you know, from there on, you're just as good. If you've worked up the underage pathway, you've probably a lot of rugby under your belt anyway. So you're probably thereabouts with your teammates. You know, age is just a number. You know, I think you're more than well capable of making that jump. So jump in the deep end, but also give yourself that grace period to get used to it.
Yeah. What was your first impression of everyone when you came onto the squad as a 16-year-old? Like, it's mental that you were a 16-year-old, then you had to go play the Welsh game and then go straight into your mocks. Like, what is the mindset of a 16-year-old jumping into a squad like us?
Yeah, you know, it was a weird dynamic going from obviously secondary school, where I'm being taught by, you know, people your age, like half of you are teachers anyway, and then going in and, you know, you're my teammates. So it was a weird dynamic and it was a weird shift at the start. I remember one time Rugby Players Ireland came in and they were giving a talk about all the, like, services that they offer. And I was there trying to, like, scribble down my maths homework, and they were talking about, you know, pension advice. And I was just like, what in the world am I doing here? Like, what is going on? Pension advice, I haven't even done like fifth year exams. But no, like, obviously I grew into it and now I love it. I take the slagging as much as I give it. But that first year, it was definitely a weird dynamic and I was still finding my feet. And, you know, at 16, you're not always sure of yourself. And then going into a well-established squad, it can be a bit difficult. But, you know, I'm glad I've had the years under my belt now. I can take the slagging.
Yeah, you've slotted in seamlessly. Darrow, when you joined the squad, like, what players really helped you along the way, or what coaches or what people in general helped you along the way to for advice, or who would you go to for advice if you weren't really sure?
I suppose as well as being a bully, like, Junior has definitely helped me a lot. Like, she'd, you know, she kind of, I get a lot of slagging, but there's a lot of useful things she tells me too. And I think, to be honest, anyone in the forward pack, Hannah O'Connor is a wealth of knowledge and so skillful. Laura Feely's the same. Like, there's loads of girls there who just loads of experience that is just there for us to take, really. So, like, Junior has been particularly helpful, but there's lots of, just forwards wise, obviously the backs are so knowledgeable as well. But for me, those would be the standouts, I think.
Yeah, thanks for that there. I suppose looking ahead to this year's Six Nations, we face Wales next Saturday in Cardiff Arms Park at 5 p.m. It's on RTE as well, so it's very exciting. Dorothy, it's been so long. How excited are you to get started?
Oh, I'm buzzing. Can't wait. I am. It's kind of the only thing on my mind. Like, I'm just really excited to play. And I think that's all we're, I think that's kind of how we all feel. Like, we just want to be able to play a match and get going, get the whole campaign going and get in the swing of things, really.
Yeah. What about you, babe?
Yeah, I feel like we're a jack in the box, you know, when you wind it up and we've had about 20 camps under our belt and we're just going to explode. You know, we just can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And whatever team takes the park next Saturday week on the 10th, you know, I think everyone is ready at this stage. And I think there's such competition in the squad that I don't think we've ever been more ready. We're going to finish off with a quick fire round. So I'm going to ask you every second question and I'm going to start with you, Dorothy. So we'll start with Dorothy, then move on to Bavin. And I mean quick fire round. So it's the first thing that comes to your mind. All right. Dorothy.
Yeah.
One thing you would bring to a desert island?
My phone.
Bavin, one person you would take into battle with you?
Lindsay Peep.
I knew you were going to say that. She'll be delighted.
That's gonna be me.
Dorothy, how many times did it take you to pass your driving test?
I have yet to convert that. I haven't passed it.
I thought you had passed
Thank
it.
You. No, it was the most disappointing thing ever. I got about 8 grade 3s. The driving instructor was swearing at me by the end of it. It was terrible.
Oh my God, I was convinced you passed it. Bavin.
No, thanks for that.
Bavin, who has the best style on the team?
Best style. I'll say Emily.
Dorothy, who's the biggest joker on the team?
Hannah O'Connor.
Bavin, what is your cheat meal?
Scrum diddlies.
Absolutely. And Dorothy, most importantly, when is your lip gloss tutorial coming out?
This is a joke. This has just been an absolute slating of me.
It absolutely hasn't.
It's on my YouTube channel too.
Oh my God. Just for anyone who doesn't know the background on that, we had a Zoom call pretty recently. And what? Did you think your camera was off?
Oh, they went into the COVID regulations and it was like a PowerPoint in front of me. So I couldn't see faces. So I forgot that people could see me.
Yeah, she got caught rotten.
Lip gloss because it was just there in front of me.
She got absolutely caught rotten. Yeah. And there's plenty of videos doing the rounds, I think, of Dorothy's lip gloss application.
The worst thing was, though, the next training, Griggsy said it to me in the warm-up. He was like, oh, nice lip gloss, Dorothy. I was like, oh, thank you.
No, it is nothing worse.
I was so low at that point. Oh, God.
You probably got it from the players group, and then you didn't think management knew about it, so there's nothing worse.
Oh, no, I thought, okay, maybe I've gotten away with it. Then Griggsy says it to me, head coach. I was like, oh, class.
Girls, thank you so much for coming on today. It has been one of the most enjoyable chats I've had. I hope that everyone really enjoys listening to both Dorothy Wall and Beavan Parsons, who hopefully will be ripping it up in this year's Women's Six Nations. And our first game starts Saturday week, the 10th, against Wales in Cardiff Arms Park at 5 p.m. So make sure that you tune in on RTE.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. Game changed.